Did God need evil to exist in order to enact his plan? I mean, after all, without evil, there would have been no original sin. Without the original sin, there would be no need for redemption. And redemption is the bulk of the biblical narrative and the narrative of our history. So didn't God technically need for evil to exist in order for his plan to come to fruition? And also, how do you fight evil? The answer to that question might be a little surprising to you. We're going to discuss these topics on this week's episode of the Faith by Reason podcast. Welcome to the podcast. The website behind it all, as always, is faithbyreason.net. There's a ton of information there, the blog and these podcasts and our social media. Please check it out. So I need to apologize again for the lateness of this podcast. It wasn't really my fault this time. I'm unfortunately in an area where we're experiencing the effects of a couple of natural disasters. So that along with other busyness has really sapped my time and not given me the time and energy that I needed in order to keep up with the podcast. So sorry about that. Unfortunately, it's going to still be a little sporadic throughout the rest of this month because I'll be doing some traveling. So there probably won't be a podcast next week. Sorry about that. But I will try to get it together and be as regular as I can after these events. So let's dive into this week's topic. Does God need evil? Yeah, on the surface, it kind of sounds almost sacrilegious. God doesn't need evil. God is good. What on earth would he need evil for? But when you think about the way I framed the question at the beginning of this podcast, as well as the end of the last podcast, look at the plan of redemption. That is really what our entire history as human beings on this earth is all about from a biblical standpoint. You know, most of the 90%+ of the Bible, I would say 95% of the Bible, is about the redemption. You know, you have the first two chapters of Genesis where, you know, God creates everything and he creates man and woman. And then from the middle of Genesis 3, where they commit original sin, all the way to the end of Revelation, it's all about man's fall and all the things that God did to redeem him. All the different dispensations from the second dispensation on to the very end of the seventh dispensation. It's all about redemption. So without that sin, there would be no need for the rest of the Bible. So it is logical to ask the question, did God need evil? It would seem that, you know, we wouldn't have our narrative of our history, the sacrifice of Christ on the cross and that great show of love would not have been necessary without evil. And remember, at the end of the last podcast, we talked about the people who believe in dualism, and that dualism, or that idea of duality, is that you need opposites in order to have a balance. You need evil in order to have good. That these dualists, or these people who follow the idea of duality, would tell you that if it wasn't for evil, you wouldn't really know what good was. You wouldn't have anything to compare it to. Therefore, you need evil to exist in order for good to exist. Is that true? Well, we know that it's not true, that good does not need evil to exist, because actually on its own, evil cannot exist. Because evil is destruction. We talked about this in the last podcast. Good is to create in the long term. Evil is to destroy in the long term. And you can't destroy something unless something's been created first. You have to have something to destroy. Without creation, there can be no destruction. Therefore, without good, there can be no evil. However, you don't need destruction in order to create something. You can paint a picture without someone tearing it up first. I mean, actually, that's impossible. No one can tear something down until you've built it first. So you can create forever without any destruction. Destruction is not necessary. You do not need destruction to create. And that's really what eternity is going to be all about, when evil is vanquished from our existence and we are in the state of heaven, which, you know, we'll talk about way, way down the road. But it will be an eternity of constant creation, and there will be no evil because there's no need for it. Good can exist without evil. Creation can happen without destruction. I think that's pretty logical, and I think we understand that. But what about redemption? What about God's plan? Well, let's go back and look at remember what we talked about in the podcast and the blog about God's plan. God's plan was not necessarily redemption. When you look at the basics, the bottom rung on the ladder of what God's plan is, God's plan is simply for us to be with him forever, which means we have to be like him. Now, redemption became necessary because we are not like him, and there needs to be an apparatus in place for us to become like him. However, redemption was not, is not the plan. The plan is to be with God and be like God. That is what the dispensations are. Now, God knows that it's not possible for us to do that technically. It's not possible because we are not like him already. We're not always and completely right and just. So we need to have an apparatus in place to render us always and completely right and just. And that's what salvation is all about when you get right down to it. However, while it's not practically possible, it's theoretically possible for us to choose to be like God on our own because we have free will. And we can act outside of our imperfect nature and we can choose to be like God. Again, theoretically, even though practically we can't, but theoretically we could. And because that theoretical possibility exists, that's what the dispensations are all about. They're God's contrastive way of showing, giving us every opportunity, giving man every opportunity to choose to be like God on his own. And of course, we keep failing at it. And that's the whole point. But again, it's theoretically possible for the first dispensation to have been successful without there being any evil, without, you know, evil getting involved or them choosing evil. Adam and Eve could have technically turned down the serpent's offer. I mean, they could have theoretically turned down the serpent's offer and just walked with God forever. And as long as they were walking with God, they never would have died. And God would have achieved his plan on a small level where this man and this woman is, barring them not reproducing, would have walked with him forever, and God would have had what he wanted, which was mankind, which was just two people at the time, being with him and being like him forever because they simply obeyed him and only listened to him. So that could have happened. It didn't, but it could have. And if that had happened theoretically, then that God's plan would have been successful. He would have had what he wanted. He would have had two more people to add to the Trinity. He would have had these, Adam and Eve would have been part of the Godhead. I mean, they were already his image bearers, so that they just would have continued as they were. And again, God would have gotten what he wanted, but it didn't happen, and God knew it wouldn't happen. But again, the possibility existed. So God did not need evil. What he needed was for man to embrace good. Man just chose not to. The redemption was actually God's contingency plan. It wasn't what he wanted. God did not want to curse Adam and Eve. He did not want to judge them. He didn't set them up to fail. And we're going to talk about that at the end of this podcast and the beginning of the next podcast, what their failure really meant and what the bad guys say about them. By the bad guys, I mean Satan and those who follow Satan, what they have an alternative history. And we'll talk about that in the next podcast and the end of this one. But, you know, God loved Adam and Eve. He wanted the best for them. But, you know, just he knew that they were going to fail. And knowing someone is going to fail doesn't mean you made them fail. There's no determinism in that sense. So to wrap that up, God does not need evil to exist. He did not need evil for his plan to come to fruition. But he knew that evil was going to occur. And he knew that Adam and Eve were going to fall. And he had his contingency plan of redemption ready for it when it happened. And probably the final and most ultimate reason we know that God does not need evil is when all the dispensations are over, when all of our history here on earth is over, and God enacts his plan, and this heaven and earth has passed away, and there's a new heaven and a new earth, and we exist with God forever, there will be no evil, and God will have his plan. He will have man with him and like him forever, and there will be no evil. So obviously God doesn't need evil to exist because except for, you know, these few thousands of years, you know, 6, 7, 8, however many thousands of years you think man has been around, it is a drop in the bucket compared to eternity, which is, again, is forever. So the vast majority of our existence, if you look into the future, will be in heaven, in eternity, without evil. So evil will only exist retrospectively for a very, very tiny amount of time. The rest of eternity, the rest of the time that we will exist will be in a state without evil. So God doesn't need evil to exist. So sorry to all of you people who believe in dualism. Of course, if you are evil, of course you believe in dualism because it justifies your existence. You say, I need to exist as an evil person because, you know, good can't exist without me. So technically, it must be good to be evil sometimes. I'm actually quoting a line from the old South Park movie, which is completely irrelevant. Never mind. Let's move on. The next question, the next topic that we want to tackle in this podcast is how do you fight evil? You know, we don't like evil. Evil is bad, obviously. Evil is not optimal. It's not what we want. How do we fight it? What do we do to fight it? Well, if you were to ask the average person, how do you fight evil? They will say, well, you fight evil with good. If something is evil, if someone is evil, you combat that evil by just being good. However, I'm actually going to disagree with that. And here's why. When we look at, again, the non-contradictory definitions of good and evil that we talked about in the last podcast of creation and destruction, I would say the worst way to fight evil is with good. Because the worst way to fight destruction is to give it more creation to destroy. If someone is destroying something, the last thing you want to do is say, hey, okay, here's some more stuff for you to destroy. Well, that's just going to actually fuel it. It's like trying to fight fire by throwing wood and kindling at it. You're not going to destroy the fire. You're actually going to give the fire more to burn. So I would say that the best way to fight evil would be to withhold good from it. Because if there's no good for the evil to destroy, then it's going to burn itself out. When firemen fight a fire, one of the main things they do is they clear the brush and all the debris in the path of the fire, and the fire will burn itself out. It has nothing else to burn. I mean, that's what they do. That's one of the main ways they fight it, by not giving it fuel. And good is evil's fuel. So what are some practical examples of it? Well, I can give you a practical example from an earlier podcast. When I deal with atheists, and I think I dealt with them in the seventh podcast in the series on love. When atheists, they're evil in that they are destructive. Their goal is to destroy faith, particularly the Christian faith. They don't seem to be as angry with Muslims or Hindus or anything like that. Atheists seem to just really want to destroy Christianity. And if you fight an atheist and all you keep doing is giving them you're good, if you keep trying to give them good arguments, all they're going to do is just destroy those arguments. They're going to take them down. But the main way, the most effective way I found to fight atheists is to do what I did in that podcast, which is don't fall into the trap they set for you. Remember in that podcast, an atheist came to me and said, you know, do you believe that God is a God of love? And what he wanted me to do was give him good and say, oh yes, of course, God is a God of love. You know, he's a God, he's just a loving, wonderful God. And then of course the atheist would tear that down by saying, well, if God is really good, then why are there rape and murder and drug use and starvation? Why would a good God allow that? But instead of doing that, giving him what he wanted, I just withheld it from him. I say, yeah, you know what, God is not a God of good. And that stopped him. God is not a God of love. And that stopped him right there, because he was expecting me to give him more fuel to burn. And by the way, the full answer to the question is God is not a God of love, because when you asking what someone is of, you're asking about their nature, and God's nature is not love. God's nature is always and completely right and just. That's the cause. One of the effects of being always and completely right and just is love, but God is not a God of love. That's not his cause. Love is an effect. And so, but the point is that once I withheld the argument that he wanted from him that would have given him fuel to fight me with his pre-planned arguments, he had no place else to go. He was essentially defeated. I mean, every argument you've gotten into with the person, they can only keep arguing with you if you keep giving them things to fight. But if you stop giving them things to fight, they can't fight with you anymore. Which is why one of the reasons why Jesus says to agree with your enemy, because you can't fight with someone who is in agreement with you. But the good thing about agreeing with someone who is evil, it will burn itself out, because evil can't exist on its own. I will give you an example. Or rather, I will give you an exercise to use the next time someone comes to you with a destructive purpose in mind, be it an atheist disparaging your faith, or be it someone at work who wants to gossip about someone and tear them down. What you want to do is hypothetically agree with them and then ask them the question why 5 times. For example, let's say an atheist comes to you and he or she says, well, you know, why Christians are so intolerant. Okay, let's say Christians are intolerant. Why is it wrong to be intolerant? And when they answer you, ask them why again. Just keep asking them why. The reason you do it, because when you ask someone why, you're forcing them to explain their position. And if their only position is to destroy, and you keep asking them why, they will run out of things to destroy, because you are not giving them any fuel. You are just, you are allowing them to burn themselves out. You are just trying to, you give them nothing but evil to work on, and they cannot do it because they will run out of things to be destructive about. You know, the gossiper, you say, oh, I saw our coworker out late last night, you know, getting drunk. You say, okay, well, let's say she was. You know, why are you telling me this? Well, because, you know, I think we need to know about this person. Well, why do we need to know about her? Well, because she, you know, she shouldn't be out that late and getting drunk. Oh, really? Well, if that's her personal business, why is it wrong? You just keep asking them why, and they're going to burn themselves out, because what they really want is for you to give them something for them to continue to destroy. And if you deny them that, they have nothing left. They're completely bereft of destruction. I gave an innocuous example of this on the blog post that goes along with this topic about the Golden State Warriors and myself being a tacit Laker fan. And now, before I get into that, and you can, of course, I'll have it linked in the show notes. Before I get into that, I've got to address something that happens every time someone comes across the article that I originally wrote on the blog that, again, deals with this subject back in 2010. And I used the Golden State Warriors as an example of an inferior franchise that was as inferior to the Lakers, the Los Angeles Lakers. Now, I grew up in Los Angeles. My parents were big Laker fans, and so that kind of, you know, translated over to me because they were cheering for them, and, you know, I was in the house with them, and I started cheering for the Lakers too. I mean, you're in LA, you cheer for the Lakers. You cheer for your local sports team generally. Now, that said, these days I don't follow the Lakers. I don't follow much sports at all, because the older I get, the less relevant sports becomes to me. I have more important things to think about. I have family and, you know, the things in business and things I'm trying to do, so I don't really care about sports that much. And so it doesn't really matter. But back then, you know, I was a pretty vociferous Laker fan. And in the blog post, I talk about a Golden State Warrior fan and how he would always get on my nerves because he hated the Lakers because they're rivals. Well, sort of. At least back then in 2010, they're still an inferior franchise. Now, let me explain the difference between a team and a franchise. Yes, currently, as we speak here in 2017, the Golden State Warriors are the champions. They have a very good team. I don't have a problem with them. Like I said, I'm not a big sports fan anymore. I don't care about the rivalry. Steph Curry seems like a good kid, you know, and good for him. No problems with the Warriors at all. But if you talk, but they're a good team right now, and the Lakers, frankly, aren't very good. I don't know how bad they are. I think they were in the lottery, so they probably weren't very good last year. But I'm not talking about teams. I'm talking about franchises. And you measure franchises by championships. The Lakers have 14 championships. The Warriors have 3. Now, I'm not a math major. I'm not a mathematician. But I'm pretty sure that 14 is a lot higher than 3. So even though the Lakers are down now and the Warriors are up, the Lakers are still a superior franchise because they have more overall success in their decades of existence than the Warriors do. So all you Warrior fans out there who keep giving me a bunch of crap about how good the Warriors are now, tell you what, you win 10 more championships and then we'll talk. And until then, the Lakers are still the superior franchise. So back to the story. What would happen is this Warrior fan, which back in, you know, I think this was back in like 05 when the Warriors still sucked, He was still a fan of theirs, and he would come to me and he would talk crap about the Lakers. And in response to him, I would throw statistics at him. I would throw facts at him. He would just destroy the facts. He would just come up with some of these ridiculous arguments against the facts I threw at him. And the more facts I gave him, you know, the more he would kind of ignore them and twist them around. And it would frustrate me. But what he was doing, he was trying to destroy that part of Laker fandom that I represented. And he could do that as long as I kept giving him facts. I'd say, you know, well, the Lakers have more championships. Yeah, well, you know, he would say the referees gave the Lakers all the breaks. That's why they have championships. You know, they were steal players. You know, they stole Magic Johnson. She shouldn't have been there and blah, blah, blah. He would just come up with ridiculous arguments that would frustrate me because I was giving him facts and things that, you know, I would talk about their scoring record and the way they play defense and the good they've done for the league and so forth and so on. He would just disparage it. But what I did instead, I just stopped giving him stuff. When he would say, oh, the Lakers suck, okay, maybe they do. His entire argument was predicated on me defending the Lakers. And when I didn't defend them, he had nothing left because he was trying to be, quote unquote, evil in a very innocuous way, but by being destructive. And I just didn't give him anything to destroy. So So the way you fight evil, the way you fight it is by withholding good from it. Without good, evil cannot exist. Now, I need to address a verse that would seem to contradict what I'm saying, but it actually doesn't when you look at the verse in context. And that verse is, Romans chapter 12, 20 and 21, where it ends by saying, verse 21 says, don't be overcome by evil, overcome evil with good. So that seems to say you should fight evil with good. However, if you read the previous verse, verse 20, it says, and I'll just quote it here. It says, but if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him drink. For by doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, overcome evil with good. So in context, it's not talking about creation. It's not talking about giving your enemy something creative. It's talking about your attitude towards him. And it's talking more about justice, because that point about heaping hot coals on his head is really a form of punishment. What are you doing when you are being kind to someone who is being evil to you? Well, you're actually being loving towards them. And you're being loving to someone who's being unjust to you. So, under the rules of justice, you know, there's an imbalance in justice. You're being nice to someone. You're having a good attitude and doing nice things for someone who has bad intentions for you. So God has to equal out justice, because God is just. And that means that person who was being evil to you, who's being mean to you, will have to be judged by God. So it's actually a way to punish the evil person is by being nice to them. Because if you are nice to someone who is doing wrong to you, then again, God has to balance that justice out. So it's really, that verse is about the attitude you have towards someone who is evil. Not only would that stop them generally, because if someone's being mean to you and you're being nice to them, well, in some cases, they may stop being mean to you because they may feel some guilt and shame. But if they don't feel that guilt and shame, you're putting them in the position to be judged. So even though you're being benevolent towards them, what you're actually doing is heaping hot coals of judgment on them, because God will have to equal out that justice. So that's what that verse means. It goes back to the idea I talked about a few minutes ago, which was agreeing with your enemy quickly. When you agree with your enemy, well, that takes away the fight. And if you are kind to someone who is being unkind to you, well, now God has to step in and judge them. I mean, if someone's unkind to you and you're unkind to them, well, then you balance justice out on your own. But I would rather God balance out my justice, because he's going to be more thorough than I am. So when someone is being mean to you, be nice to them. Not because it makes you feel good, but because you know that you serve a God who is just, and he will pay that back, that justice. So that's what that's all about. So that wraps up our discussion of good and evil, and it also wraps up the discussion of life and death, which means we've talked about the two trees in the garden, the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. We've gotten that behind us. But that brings us to another point. Why did eating of that tree result in death? What really happened to Adam and Eve when they ate of the tree? Something physically and mentally happened to them. We're going to talk about that in the next podcast. And it's important to address that because of a religious theory, an evil religious theory or religious dogma that comes from the enemy that paints a completely different picture of this. Remember in the last podcast, at the end of the last podcast, I talked about the mystics and the Satanists and who believe in this whole thing of duality, that, you know, evil and good are in balance and they need to remain in balance. And the only reason I mention it is because, as I said, I got a little conspiratorial, and to let you know that a lot of people in very high positions of power ascribe to this mystic occultic idea of the balance of good and evil. And these people they hate Christianity, most, and not just because Christianity is true and it's good and that they're evil, but they hate Christianity specifically because they believe that Christianity is a perversion of their religious, their occultic religious beliefs, it's a complete inversion of Christianity, where they paint Satan as the good guy. Wait a minute, how is Satan the good guy? Well, they have a different tact, a different idea of what happened in the Garden of Eden. They don't see the temptation to eat the tree of the forbidden fruit as a bad thing that Satan tempted Adam and Eve towards, but they see it as a good thing, that what Satan was doing was taking these ignorant, people who, this man and woman who didn't know anything, and giving them knowledge, giving them enlightenment, giving them illumination. And that's where you get all the, that's some of the part of the genesis of the term Illuminati, but I'm not going to get into all that. That's way too far afield in conspiracy theory for the purposes of this podcast. But they believed that Satan was the good guy, that God was the bad guy, that God created man and woman in this state of ignorance and oppression, and that Satan was the good guy who enlightened them, who wanted them to have knowledge. And, you know, it's like this, like the tale of Prometheus from Greek mythology, who brought down fire to mankind and made man more industrious and more self-aware. So they believe that Adam and Eve were basically automatons. They were just robots who were, you know, who were denied sentience by the God of the Bible, who was actually an evil God. And Satan was the good guy who wanted them to be enlightened, who wanted them to have full knowledge and full sentience and to understand good and evil. So he told them to eat of this tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and they would suddenly be, they would be like the gods. They would have full knowledge that God was, that the God of the Bible was denying them. Now, of course, this is nonsense and it's heresy, but it's actually believed by a lot of these people in power. They, and a lot of them don't believe in a physical Satan, a physical devil. They, what they really believe in is that man can be God, that man is the ultimate creation, and that they see the Eden narrative as a symbol of man finding his way to enlightenment. And they see Christianity as the opposite. Christianity wants man to be oppressed and subservient to some God they don't even believe exists. So that's why, that's one of the reasons why they hate Christianity so much, and that the more Christianity fades, the more these people who are evil gain power, and as they gain more power, they try to crush Christianity even more. I mean, in our society, Christianity is vilified. I mean, here in America, 100 years ago, being a Christian was a virtue. These days, if you're a Christian, it's actually, you're actually disparaged, and you're considered, in, you know, ignorant, unscientific, oppressive, intolerant, homophobic, racist, all the different things right now. So, you know, being a Christian is not popular in our culture. Being an atheist or being any other religion, frankly, if you're a Muslim, you're great. If you're an atheist, you're fine. If you're any other religion other than Christianity, you're okay. But if you're a Christian, yeah, you're disparaged. You're the bad guy now, which is a complete reversal of the way things were. But as I said, as Christian influence fades, as Christians become less powerful in our faith, which has been happening over the last 50 years, well, that vacuum is filled by evil, and the evil people want to destroy Christianity, and they're doing a pretty good job of it, and we're doing a pretty good job of it ourselves. But in the next podcast, we are going to talk about not only why that idea of Satan being the good guy is silly, we're going to talk about what exactly happened when Adam and Eve ate the fruit, when they gained the knowledge of good and evil. What did they gain knowledge truly of, and how did it affect them, and why did it make them ashamed, and how did they know they were naked, and all that stuff. We're going to talk about that in the next podcast. So thank you for listening. I appreciate it. Please send me your comments. Let me know if you disagree with my idea of how to fight evil. I actually have some good friends who do not agree with me on that, and I think it's mostly because I don't think they really understand what... they don't accept my definitions of good and evil, so if you don't accept the definition, then you probably don't accept the idea of how to fight evil. But that's fine. Please let me know. Let me know in the comments or on Facebook. And please, again, subscribe to the blog and the podcast. Just go into the area in the right margin, put your email in, and you'll get them as soon as they come out. And I will talk to you hopefully in about a week, and we'll talk about what happened when Adam and Eve ate from the tree.